caveat apology.
Counsel, you're fine. I think we, Mr. Farrell, it's my understanding that you are doing the entire argument for the appellants. Is that correct? You're not splitting time?
Yes, Your Honor. I'll be presenting arguments for both the DNR and the county today.
Okay, very good. We'll have the Marshall Call Court back into session. Thank you.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Frisch, Judge Gaitas, Judge Clary, the Honorable Jennifer L. Frisch presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is January 20, 2022. We have five cases on our calendar this morning, and this is the third of our five cases. A210829 and A210832 in the matter of the application of Timothy Moratzka. Counsel, just a few housekeeping matters before we begin. I'd ask that you mute your microphone if you are not speaking. Marshall is showing a running clock of your time. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellants will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use that. I'd ask that you identify yourself and your client before you begin speaking. And with that, counsel, you may proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Pete Farrell. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the appellant Minnesota Department of Natural Resources in this case. With me on the line today is Mike Haig, who represents the County of Itasca. Given our limited time here today, I will be presenting arguments on behalf of both the DNR and the county today. This case is about when a property owner can deny the existence of a platted lake access and what's required for a property owner to eliminate the public's rights in a platted lake access. The district court got it wrong when it held that the public's interest in Parcel 3, a platted public road that abuts Trout Lake, was extinguished by operation of the Marketable Title Act. The district court got it wrong for two reasons, each of which is an independent basis for reversal. First, because the trustee is estopped from denying the current legal existence of Parcel 3. Second, because the trustee needs to petition for vacation under Section 505.14 if he wants to eliminate the public's interest in Parcel 3 and have title adjudicated in his favor. I want to start this morning on the estoppel point because I do think that if the court agrees with the parties on the estoppel issue, it can reserve the Section 505.14 question for another day. The estoppel rule...
That point, can you just tell me what do you believe the law is with respect to what the trustee is stopped from doing? What exactly is he stopped from doing?
The rule is this, Your Honor. The trustee is stopped from denying the validity of the plat and the legal existence of the streets, alleys, and public ways depicted on the plat. And that
So I understand the first part the trustee is a stop from denying the validity of the plat, and I don't understand the trustee to be challenging the validity of the plat. What is the legal basis for the second allegation that you're making?
The legal basis, Your Honor, is a direct quote from the Minnesota Supreme Court's precedents. That rule about the legal existence of the streets is derived from the Powdler case in 1908, which has been cited several times by the Minnesota Supreme Court and also by this court. So in the Raines decision in 1958, that principle was reiterated by the Minnesota Supreme Court. It was also reiterated by this court in the Pop case in 1988. Similarly, if the court looks at the Bryant and Boland decisions, which are also discussed in the party's brief, you'll see a similar principle at play. It's not necessarily framed there in terms of estoppel, but there the court is very clear that platters and their subsequent grantees are estopped or cannot deny the existence of the streets, alleys, and public ways that are depicted on the plat. So that's the base.
I don't think the trustee is really denying what's on the validity of the plat. I think that the trustee is saying it was nevertheless abandoned under the MTA.
I agree with you that the trustee is not denying the validity of the plat, but he absolutely is denying the legal existence of parcel three. That's not disputed. That's central to his arguments here, Your Honor. And my support for that is document number one in the record. Document number one, the registration application, which contains an affirmative allegation at page seven that no public road exists on parcel three. And in fact, it's central to the trustee's arguments here on appeal. If Your Honor just considers the trustee's arguments on the vacation portion of the case, he says that the vacation statute doesn't apply because there's nothing to vacate. The trustee can't have it both ways. He can't say the estoppel rule doesn't apply and then say that the vacation statute doesn't apply because there's nothing to vacate. He's running headfirst into the estoppel bar because he is denying the legal existence of the streets, alleys, and public ways that are depicted on the plat. And that plat is expressly referenced in the deed through which he took title to the property. So he's bound by it. The district court got it wrong here. I think where the district court got tripped up is by focusing just on the validity portion of the estoppel rule. But that's not all the rule says. That's not what the Powdler case says. And that's not what the subsequent Minnesota Supreme Court cases say about the rule. The rule is broader than that. So Mr. Christie's brief is actually very careful on this point. He says, we're not denying the validity of the plat or the boundaries depicted on it. And that's what the district court bought into. But the estoppel rule is broader. It doesn't just prohibit a party from denying a plat that would otherwise be defective or, you know, prohibit a party from denying the boundaries depicted on the plat. The rule operates to prevent a party from denying the legal existence of the streets, roads, and alleys depicted on the plat. And we think that is a sufficient basis for the court to reverse the district court's order.
I wonder, though, if what Mr. Christie was really arguing is, as a factual matter, as a just a real-world factual matter, there's not a road there. And I don't think anybody disputes that.
There's not a road there. We don't dispute that as a real-world factual matter. But that brings me to my second point, which is if there's not a road there, the trustee has a remedy. And that's the remedy laid out by the legislature, which is he can petition for vacation under section 505.14 and prove up that this platted road that abuts a public water is useless for the purpose for which it was laid out. That's the remedy, the scheme that the legislature contemplated if you're going to eliminate a platted road like this, because to be sure, there is no road there currently.
I hate to go back to the first argument. I know you're trying to move on, counsel, but I mean, one of the bases for your claim of estoppel seems to be that there's a road there and there's not. I mean, that's what Mr. Christie's argument is. He's not denying the validity of the plat, and he's saying that there's not actually a road there. So I still am having a hard time understanding what is the trustee stopped from doing as a matter of law under these circumstances?
Let me push back on that a little bit, Your Honor. He is stopped from denying the legal existence of the road. That is what he is denying. That is what the estoppel rule says. You can't deny the legal existence of the road. He says there is no public interest. It's been extinguished. It is central. His arguments, his claim, his registration application doesn't make sense if that is not the case, if the court doesn't accept that premise of his argument. So he says there is no legal interest, that is what the Marketable Title Act has extinguished. And that's what we're saying the estoppel rule prohibits. That's what the Powdler case says. If I may pivot, unless there are other questions on the estoppel issue, I do want to address the road vacation statute question. And before I dive into some of the statutory nitty-gritty, let me just briefly put Section 505.14 in context. So Section 505.14 is part of Chapter 505, and Chapter 505 governs the platting of property in Minnesota. And what Chapter 505 does is provide a legal blueprint for the creation, recording, and alteration of interests created by recorded plat. And Section 505.14 is an important part of that blueprint. That's where the legislature set out a comprehensive scheme that lays out the roadmap for a property owner to eliminate or alter streets, alleys, or public ways that are depicted on a plat. And the statute does a number of important things. It establishes certain procedural requirements, personal service, publication, posted notice. It establishes certain hearing requirements. Affected landowners have a right to be heard and potentially a damages assessment. And critically, it establishes a proof requirement. A proof requirement that's at its height when you're dealing with a platted road like this, one that abuts public waters, because those platted roads are special. They are presumed as a matter of law when they're dedicated to public use to provide the public with access to a valuable natural resource like Trout Lake. That's what the Minnesota Supreme Court said in the Bryant decision and also the Schaller decision, both of which are cited in our briefs. And so if Mr. Muratska wants to, if the trustee wants to eliminate that road, the legislature has laid out a scheme that allows him to do so, and then he can seek to register title. But the trustee is...
But doesn't the MTA also allow the same avenue? I mean, how do you get around hoding? I mean, were we held that the MTA can be used for the purposes of discharging a public road?
Your Honor, I don't think any of the cases, I think all the cases in this area derive from the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in Sterling, and all of these cases don't confront the issue that the court's confronted with here. It just wasn't raised, which is whether the Marketable Title Act was intended to reach interests that are founded upon a recorded plat. And we just don't think that's the best reading of the statute. And let me really zero in on why I don't think the Marketable Title Act applies. So first of all, I don't think you can raise a Marketable Title Act claim like this. Judge Lansing's decision in the Paternos case is very emphatic on this point. There's a lot going on in Paternos, but one aspect of her holding there, one aspect of it was, this is a defensive statute. It's in Chapter 541, which is where the statutes of limitations appear. It is designed to be invoked as a defense. It's not designed to be invoked as an affirmative basis for relief. So we think there's a problem there.
What about Hess? I mean, that's a Supreme Court case that says that the MTA can be used for the property owner's own benefit.
I don't think Hess resolves the issue of whether the claim can be brought affirmatively. I mean, the issue we're making on the, I mean, you like, it's certainly true that if the county or the DNR, for example, had brought an action against the resort owner, then I do think that the resort owner would be free to invoke the Marketable Title Act as an affirmative defense. He can invoke the statute for his benefit. But the odd thing about what's going on here is that he's basically using a statute of limitations. It would be akin to bringing a contract action to get a declaration of non-liability. Statute of limitations are meant to keep claims out of court, not to bring claims to court, which is what the trustee has done here. But even if the court disagrees with me on the oddity of the procedural posture, I still think that there's a fundamental problem here, which is that the trustee's interpretation of the Marketable Title Act just directly conflicts with Supreme Court precedent and Chapter 505. And I really want to draw the court's attention to the Bolin case from 2008 that's discussed extensively in the party's briefs. The trustee does not address it in his response brief, but that is a 2008 decision from the Minnesota Supreme Court dealing with a 1902 plat and a road that had never been developed, the same kind of road that you're talking about, Judge Frisch, the same kind of road that just doesn't exist. And Justice Anderson is emphatic in that opinion. This court held unanimously that the public has an interest in an undeveloped platted street, and that those within the plat are entitled to rely on the streets depicted on the plat and possess the right to use the same. If the court is going to hold that the Marketable Title Act just wholesale wiped out streets, alleys, and public ways that are depicted by plats, then I think that just creates a fundamental conflict with Supreme Court precedent and also Chapter 505, which of course mandates that plats are to be recorded, available for inspection. These are not old, ancient, unrecorded interests that the legislature was contemplating extinguishing when it adopted the Marketable Title Act. Let me just make one more brief pitch on that point. I think the Marketable Title Act is at minimum ambiguous as to whether it applies to an interest founded upon a recorded plat. 541.023 sub 2, that sort of lays out what the statute applies to. And it basically says it applies to a property interest founded upon an instrument, event, or transaction. And I'll concede that is broad language. But if you go back and look at the legislative history of the statute, and our brief walks through this, what the statute doesn't say is that it applies to interests founded by a recorded plat. And plat is a term of art in the state's real property laws. And it was originally referred to in the 1943 version of the Marketable Title Act. Platted property provided the baseline for protection. So we know that when the drafters of the MTA were talking about the Marketable Title Act and using the word instrument, transaction, and event, they didn't use those terms to mean the same thing as plat. Let me just very briefly conclude, Your Honor. We think for both of these reasons, the estoppel doctrine, and because the Marketable Title Act does not apply, this court should reverse.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Mr. Christie, I see that we have reset the clock for you. Anytime you're ready, sir.
Good morning, Your Honors. I am Alan Christie, and I'm representing, of course, Timothy DeMaratska, the applicant in the proceeding. And I'm here with Julie Nagorski, who's also been on the briefs, but I'll be presenting our position. Being somewhat presumptuous, maybe I'm going to start responding to the questions that you propounded to Mr. Farrell, assuming that you'd maybe like to hear from us on those as well. But preliminarily, I do want to make one thing clear. There is no genuine issue of material fact here. Parties haven't raised any, there don't exist any, and for that reason, the trial court indeed appropriately proceeded with and then ultimately granted our motion for summary judgment. One thing to bear in mind, because it's important in responding to every question that I've heard asked so far, to bear in mind is that there's three parcels for which we seek registration. Parcel one are lots 13 through 17, I believe, within the plat itself. Parcel two is a small slip of land between the northerly boundary of the plat on one hand and the northerly boundary of the government lot within which the plat is situated. It just somehow escaped the platting process, but it's a narrow slip of land. It goes along with the plat, and we've asserted title to it and seek to register that. The third is parcel three. The important thing to note is that parcel three is, as is the trustee's property, entirely situated within the plat. We're not dealing with, for example, take the Paternos case. That roadway was excluded from the purchase. And getting to one point here about using the statute as a sword, not a shield, what the court clearly has indicated is that you can't use the Marketable Title Act to establish a title, to create a title. What you can use it for, however, if you have title, is to eliminate cogs on marketability. And in this case, because Maratska, the applicant, owns the lots on each side of parcel three, which all is entirely within the plat, upon extinguishment of the easement for the roadway established on plat dedication in 1912, to the center line of that roadway goes the property adjacent to the lot on one side and the property adjacent to the roadway on the other side, both of which are owned by Maratska. So important to bear in mind, because of the geographical situation of the land here, is that all this is within the plat, and it's clear that upon plat dedication, the underlying fee goes with the platting party and his successors and assigns, subject to an easement for the roadway. So we're clearing an easement. We're not creating title here. We're simply addressing a defect that affects the marketability of the title.
Yeah, I think we understand that, Mr. Christie. I would like you to focus on the argument that Mr. Farrell is making in the estoppel context, and that is, we understand that you're not denying the validity of the actual validity of the plat.
Right.
His argument is that now you're stopped from denying the legal existence of the roadway. Can you address that?
Yes, ma'am. Absolutely. The boundaries are the boundaries, and we don't seek to change the boundaries. We're not seeking to expand the boundaries. We're not saying that half of the roadway is included within lot 13 and half of the other half is included, or excuse me, lot 15 and the other half within lot 16. We're not doing that. And that is typically what has occurred in the cases that have included the language about estoppel. You can't change the boundaries. The boundaries are the boundaries. The whole platting process is to simplify legal descriptions and establish those boundaries. We're not seeking to do that in the least. But the legislature has spoken. I'm reminded in reviewing my notes this morning of a saying that was frequently quoted by an old friend of mine, Jack Davies. Jack was fond of remarking that none of our liberty or property is safe when the legislature is in session. In 1912, the plat dedicated parcel 3. It resulted in an easement for a roadway that's never been used. You know, let me state that. Never been used, never been a road, never developed, never maintained. It's always been part of a beach for the housekeeping resort there. But in 1943, for the first time, the legislature spoke. The legislature adopted the Marketable Title Act. Now, legislative acts change zoning. They change land use regulations. They change all kinds of burdens, rights, and benefits. That's what the legislative acts do. So the simple use of a word forever, for example, in a plat or a deed, which is no more than historical customary conveyancing language, does not fix for time immemorial, in perpetuity, rights, burdens, and benefits. The legislature, I think we all recognize, has the ability to alter or to change that. And that's exactly what happened in 1943 for the first time when the legislature adopted the Marketable Title Act. Let me continue on here to mention that the Proudler decision, name's been bantered about, it's important to maintain in mind a couple of distinctions. Proudler, first of all, was a 1908 case. It involved an 1890 plat dedicating a park. Now, when you dedicate a park, that vests in the government in trust for the benefit of the public fee title. It's not just an easement for roadway purposes. The reason there's an easement for roadway purposes is a roadway is not continuously, exclusively possessed by the governmental entity. If, for example, if you dedicate land for a courthouse, you dedicate land for a park, it goes to the governmental authority, and that's more consistent with a fee title. And that's why from the beginning of the platting statutes back, I think, 1858, that's why dedication of things other than a road resulted in a fee title. Secondly, let me mention with regard to Proudley. The Marketable Title Act didn't exist till 1943. So there's no question about whether the Marketable Title Act might have applied, should have applied, what it would have done. But note as well, there was 16 years there is all. I mean, if it applied, it wouldn't have done anything. And further, there was actual use of that parkland by neighbors in conjunction with an adjoining parcel of property. Proudler does not suggest in this context fixing for time immemorial in perpetuity rights which once accrued or were created by plat dedication of a roadway easement. Raines versus Village of Alden, for example, the claim was that boundaries of lots in a plat should be moved into a roadway to, in fact, enlarge the lot. That's not what we're doing. Nobody is changing a legal description here. Nobody is changing a boundary. We've got parcel one, as I've described it, parcel two, as I've described it, and parcel three. The only question is whether the easement over the originally dedicated parcel three has been eliminated by the Marketable Title Act. Similarly, Pop versus County of Winona also sought to modify or deny the boundaries in a plat. Nope, that's just not what we're doing. That's not an issue. And to the extent that I've indicated that it's never been a roadway, I factually, that's accurate. It never has been. Comment was also made about 505.14 being the exclusive means of vacation. I'm paraphrasing what I perceive to be the argument anyway of the county and the DNR. First of all, 505.14 does not state that it is the exclusive means of vacation. It does not so provide. In fact, it says that upon application and proof, a district court may modify a plat boundaries, and it's broad, anything in a plat, or may vacate. But it doesn't state that that is the exclusive means. Secondly, 541.023 contains a fair number of exceptions and exclusions. I'm not going to run through them in detail. We could, but I don't think that serves the purpose. The point is simply because 541.023 does include exceptions and exclusions. That is an expression of legislative intent about what that statute does not apply to. It is not licensed for us to extrapolate and go beyond. By virtue of indicating the exceptions and the exclusions, by negative implication, there are no others. Further, in the town of Sterling versus Griffin, it's interesting to note, and our brief goes on about the ways in which township roads may be created, essentially four different ways. Point being that in each of those instances, it creates an easement for the town. So there are similarities. But in Township of Sterling versus Griffin, that's one where the township road was created by township board order. And in that case, it was 167.07 was the statute pursuant to which the order was issued. That very statute, in a manner similar to 505.14, provides for modifications of township roads established in that fashion by petition to the court. Yet, even though those statutory schemes, 505.14 and 167.07, had that similarity, the court there went on to hold, that the Marketable Title Act in fact applied. And that's exactly what we're basically seeking to do here. Further, Your Honor, the canons of construction, if we look at legislative interpretation, the legislature intends all of its acts to be given effect. And so we really ought not read one is nullifying another if it's possible to avoid that, if it's possible to give them all effect. And essentially, that's the mandate of 645.26 subdivision one. Now here, if the MTA does not bar the easement, if it's held inapplicable because of 505.14, essentially we're doing violence and we're not giving any meaning to 541.023. Similarly, if you were to hold in no instance that 505.14 is applicable and that it's all superseded by 541.023, we'd have the same situation. And what I'm going to suggest is that it's possible to give both effect, consistent with the legislatively pronounced public policy in 541.023 in subdivision 5. In other words, if we look at a situation, if the Marketable Title Act by its terms bars an interest, a source of title 40 years old, a defect in title or a clog on marketability that is more than 40 years old, so that some prima facie presumptively it's extinguished. If that is the case, then there's nothing for 50514 to operate on. There's you don't go to vacate something that no longer exists, which would no longer exist because the legislature has spoken. And in terms of what's ancient, let me just a side comment. In terms of what's the legislature has spoken, it's 40 years. I mean, that's what the legislature has done. But similarly, we can give effect to 50514 for all those instances in which the conditions of the Marketable Title Act are not met. If you're within the first 40 years, the legislature has decided, well, you know, let people have 40 years to make use of the property and of the interest, or otherwise, let them file a notice. It's a relatively minimal burden to perpetuate these things. File a notice. And so if we're in those types of scenarios, 50514 can be given effect. And by virtue of that kind of analysis, you give effect to both statutes, which is more consistent with the presumptive legislative intent that they both be given effect to the extent possible, and that 645.26 subdivision 1 is met. 645.26 subdivision 1 also says if you can't avoid a conflict, an irreconcilable conflict, between a general provision and a specific provision. And I have a hard time deciding as between these two statutes, frankly, which is more general and which is specific. So I'm not sure that's particularly instructive. But in that case,
Mr. Christie, time has expired, sir. If you just want to briefly.
Oh, I was just going to say, in that case, you look to the latter enacted or adopted statute, which is 541.023, and that does contain a specific pronouncement of public policy. And when looking at two statutes that arguably are at loggerheads with each other, it should be the legislative pronouncement of public policy that governs. There are two legislative acts. The legislature has acted.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Christie.
I apologize for running over. My apologies.
You're fine.
I get excited about these things. You can tell. I'm sorry.
Don't apologize. Judge Cleary, I see that your hand is raised. You want me to lower that for you, or did you have a question? You're muted. Oh, you lowered it yourself. You're good to go. Okay. Very good. Mr. Farrell, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it, sir. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Your Honor. And let me try to match Mr. Christie's enthusiasm here. So briefly on the estoppel point, I just want to make sure we're on the same page here, because I did go back and double check that legal existence language that I cited to you. It is in the Powdler case, which specifically says the platters and their grantees are estopped to deny the legal existence of such streets and public grounds as are described in the plat. Mr. Christie is certainly correct that Powdler is a 1908 case, but that principle has been cited in several cases that post-date the enactment of the Marketable Title Act, and it has been applied in that court in a number of scenarios that post-date the enactment of the Marketable Title Act. Second, on the estoppel point, I heard Mr. Christie talk about several of the cases, but I still have not heard him address the Bolin case, which again is a case from the Minnesota Supreme Court, 2008, dealing with a 1902 plat and a road that had never been developed by anyone. And the Supreme Court there was emphatic that the public had an interest in the undeveloped street, and that the property owner in that case, he had possessed a right to use it. Purchasers within the plat had the right to rely on the plat. Again, I don't think the court can address this case and get around the estoppel rule without trying to square that circle. I don't think it can be squared. Bolin forecloses the relief the trustee is seeking here. Third, Your Honor, I just want to briefly note that if ever there were a case that called out for application of the estoppel doctrine, then this is that case. And what I mean by that is this. Not only is this an interest that people were aware of by virtue of the fact that the plat was recorded, there's been a longstanding dispute over this particular parcel and the exact nature of public access. And I want to be clear that the that everyone here understood that this platted public parcel existed. Now, whether, you know,
I mean, that cuts both ways, counsel, because given that there has been a significant dispute over access to the lake and through the various property owners, it seems as though the, you know, the county would want to file the plat.
Right. What? And I don't want to get out over my skis and suggest that there's been, I just want to make clear that in terms of estoppel and whether there was notice of this interest, this isn't a case where we're dealing with an ancient unrecorded interest that no one knew about. That's not this case. And indeed, that's not going to be the case when you're dealing with plats in general. Let me also just respond to two other of Mr. Christie's points in terms of his idea that the burden of this property is going to be perpetuated from time immemorial. The DNR's argument, the county's argument, is not that the trustee has no remedy here and that his property always has to be burdened with this platted public road, again, one that abuts a valuable natural resource. Our position is just that he has to go into court and prove up that this platted public road is useless. That's what Section 505.14 prescribes. He says that he can make that showing, and if he can, then the public road will be eliminated, title will be adjudicated in his favor, and he can register the property at that time. Briefly on Township of Sterling, I think that case is distinguishable. The court is very clear there, especially when you look at the issue statement. It was dealing with a statute that only required the township to file notice of the road order with the county auditor. And the court said, look, it's well settled under Minnesota law that notice with the county auditor does not constitute notice of an interest in land. That's not the case with plats. Plats are filed with the county recorder's office, and they do constitute a notice of interest in land. Lastly, let me just conclude with this. I do want to speak a little bit about the public interest here. Obviously, there are competing public interests at stake, but if the court accepts the trustee's interpretation of the Marketable Title Act here, it could have huge consequences. There's evidence in this record from the Itasca County land manager that in Itasca County alone, there are 118 platted lake accesses, 108 of which are undeveloped. I think the court, if it accepts the trustee's argument, really risks wiping out those platted lake accesses wholesale. I don't think that's what the legislature intended by the Marketable Title Act. And indeed, the Marketable Title Act is unique. If you look at the Wickelman decision, the Supreme Court expressly said that when you're interpreting this general statute, the court is not entering the legislative field if it looks at a case and it doesn't make sense to apply the Marketable Title Act to these specific facts. These are those facts. The court should reverse the district court and hold that the trustee's application is barred under the estoppel doctrine, or alternatively, that he must petition for vacation under Section 505.14.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Anything else from the panel? All right. Very good. Thank you very much, counsel. The matter is submitted. We appreciate your submissions. They were very helpful.